This interview is taking place at the University of Maine in South Stevens Hall, and it's taking place at the Maine Folklife Center on Wednesday, October 4th, 2017. With me today are Leonard Minsky, Norman Minsky, and Jordan Alpert. My name is Elizabeth Stevens. Well, hello gentlemen, and welcome back to part two of our interview. I know last time we were talking a lot about the businesses in Bangor and the growth of the city, and I wonder if you can describe, you know, the various Jewish businesses and how they impacted the history of Bangor, Maine. And anyone who wants to begin, Leonard, you look like you want to begin.
No, John was all ready to go.
I'm happy to start.
Go ahead.
I think last time we talked about some of the retail businesses,
yes.
And you know, it certainly wasn't a comprehensive list. And I know we talked about Cortell Siegels and Alan Lewis and the Boston store, and there were a bunch of shoe stores, and I know we mentioned some jewelry stores such as Manhattan Jewelers and Crown Jewelers. There was a little store called Stryer Jewelers, probably didn't mention that. There are all kinds of retail businesses in downtown Bangor, and we've mentioned some of the pharmacies, and we probably forgot to mention Post Office Pharmacy, which was downtown, and Allen Drug, I know we mentioned, and I think Norman mentioned that Eddie Allen had two stores, one of which was out on Hammond Street, and it was a Rexall store, and then he had the store that was downtown. My dad's first drug store was downtown on Exchange Street, which was called Priest Drug Store. But Jewish people had a lot of other businesses other than retail businesses downtown. I mean, there's a clothing stores that we probably didn't mention, like Henry Siegel's, and there was a guy named David Brady, who was, I believe, on Pickering Square,
no,
on Broad
David
Street.
Brady,
was he on Broad Street?
David Brady was on actually, it was on Hammond Street. It was the building where the parking lot where the Merrill Trust is
now.
It was a wooden building,
okay,
upstairs, and David Brady's grandson and two great-grandchildren were in town 3 weeks ago, and I brought them all around town.
Oh, well, that must have been terrific for them, and probably a walk down memory lane for you. So there were all these businesses, and there were some second-tier businesses. I think, I don't know whether Norman or Leonard mentioned like Louis Saltzman's store, where he would advance money to the lumbermen, and Robert Cohen had a store downtown. It was called
and
Economy
Andy,
Clothing.
Annie Berger had one.
Right, next door to Saltzman.
I'm sorry, Leonard?
Annie Berger.
I said Annie Berger had one as well.
So these are little stores that sold clothing and lent money,
most of them started out with fairly low initial investment because they didn't have much money. You had the Richardson store, which sold magazines and candy across the street from the railroad station. And you also got to remember that because they were out picking up junk to make money. Several of the junk dealers in Bangor, when that was a going business, they became junk dealers.
Yeah, I mean, there were some big salvage yards. The Rolnicks had one, and wrecking yards. Dresner.
The biggest one was
Dresner.
Dresner.
Yeah,
Dresner.
There Bob Brown, we might have mentioned it, Brewer, and the Silvers out on, in Orono, basically.
Yeah. Well, Silvers and Gas both had them. They were side by side. They were auto. And
silver is still
gas
there.
Is still there as a and Johnny Gas's son is now running supplies for people with horses.
Yeah.
And then Silver's is still operating as a junkyard next door.
Well, automobile parts.
But
there were other types of businesses also. There were restaurants, the Miller's restaurant, there was the Orinoco restaurant, and the Kobritz family owned that.
Yeah.
They also owned a...
Max Kaminsky once owned a restaurant, the
Brass Rail.
He went belly up, I guess, there. But
Now you guys have forgotten Hancock Street.
Yeah, well, we're working our way around.
Oh, okay.
We're doing
Hancock Street had probably five butcher markets, all owned by Jews. A couple of them were kosher and a couple of them were not, and one of them, Gollop and Rolnick, was either way.
Yeah. supposedly they were side-by-side stores with the wall broken down partially between them. But there was Abe Wagman, who I think was not kosher.
Right.
There was Dr. Chasen's
father.
Who was there were also two bakeries down there back
home. Raven, Harry Raven had a kosher one.
Right, Raven had one. Schneider, who later took over Raven's, and then they opened Sklar. Then they bought Sklar's, but Sklar was there as a sort of an upscale store for a while. But there were, Hancock Street was a lively street because there were a number of Syrian and Lebanese. The whole street was lined with little stores by immigrants.
Very interesting street because there was a Pazinski store, a Karam store, a Corey store.
Yes. Lebanese, those are Lebanese families.
There were two Jewish bakeries. One was Levut. And the other one's Bangor Rye Bread. And Bangor Rye Bread, as far as I know, was started by Beryl, anglicized to Barnett, Kamenkovich. And he died very young. I believe he sold Bangor Rye Bread to Billy Cohn's grandfather. Yeah. Billy once wrote in the Washington Post that his grandfather started at Bangor Rye Bread. He has been corrected, and he acknowledges that it came from the Kamenkovich family.
There were other businesses. I mean, as the times progressed, then the businesses became more substantial. I mean, there were distribution businesses. Standard Electric, I think, is still in business. Is that not correct?
No, they were bought up.
They were bought up,
but this is a big electrical supply distribution business.
They all started, most of them started exceedingly small. I mean, right. Vina was a big shoe factory, but the father was a shoemaker.
It was a cobbler. Yeah.
And they did what they knew how to do, and then between hard work and expansion, they grew, but they all started out exceedingly small.
National Confectionery, I mean, this is the Minsky's family business.
That morphed into our paper business, and dropped the candy business.
But you had, again, it did take a great deal of capital, so Ed Capel had Bangor Candy. And Jacob Zatina had Bangor Wholesale Confectionery.
They were brothers-in-law.
They were brothers-in-law competing. but again, they all started out very small.
You know, this is kind of tangentially related, but I think it bears bringing up because so many of these businesses are gone. Not all of them, but so many of them. I mean, Rappaport Auto was the Lincoln Mercury dealer. There was Braveman Tire, so there was a diversity of businesses.
Before you get away from the confectionery company, Moran Tobacco in Old Town was eventually owned by members of his family.
That's right.
They were Alperts.
Yeah, and they ultimately moved downtown onto Pleasant Street.
Morris Alpert and Izzy Alpert, and Morris's son still, I think, works at the university at some place.
That's Michael Alpert, who's a director of the University of Maine Press. What I was going to mention was that there's there's an institution, because it's, I suppose, not really a business, that, and I think the word is, not exactly morphed, but one thing led to another, that's a prominent institution in the healthcare scene in Bangor, and I believe it's called Ross Manor. Is that what it's called? It used to be called the Sylvia Ross Home. Now, and this bears mentioning, because we were talking in our last session about, the position of Jews early on and how far they can advance it and speak English, so forth and so on. Very few people know this, but Sylvia Ross gave the money to start the Ross Home. That's why it was called the Sylvia Ross Home. And it was in those days, it was essentially what they used to call an old age home or nursing, a quasi-nursing home. Her father was named William Engel. William Engel was a German Jewish immigrant who came here in the 1870s or something like that with nothing, and he accumulated a fortune in the lumber business. He became one of the lumber barons of Bangor, and not only did he become one of the lumber barons, but he ultimately became the mayor of Bangor. Very few people are aware of that. He had one daughter whose name was Sylvia. He left his entire fortune when he died to his wife Rachel Engel and his daughter Sylvia Engel Ross, and then when the wife died, Sylvia ended up with everything, and she endowed the Sylvia Ross Home, which you know, is currently Ross Manor. So here's a guy who came here with, didn't even speak a word of English and ended up the mayor of Bangor. Now, I think it helped that he became a Unitarian. I'm not sure he really became a Unitarian. I think it just, he probably did it just to grease the wheels.
But if you want to go back that far, and fortunately none of us are quite that old, but from that initial German-Jewish migration to Bangor, there were a number of prominent business people that we haven't mentioned, and as I said, none of us really had any real contact with them, of course, because they were pretty well gone. But there was a Waterman family that had a very, very large store here at one time. And if you, we used to drive out Route 9, there was a huge barn, and the sign would still say J. Waterman Company. And then on top of that, there was a Kirstein family, they were really responsible. They were in the real estate business, the real estate, but they also developed. They developed Little City.
And Fairmount.
And Fairmount.
And Fairmount as well.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was a major contribution. That was a major family in Bangor. In fact, one of the daughters was a grade school teacher at Mary Snow School.
Augusta. I had mentioned earlier that sometime you might want to get a recording from me, because I'm apparently the only one who really knows the history of Ahavat Hashem, and I have the minute books except the ones I turned over to the library, and most of these people were involved with Ahavat Hashem, and I have a pretty good history of that. And now Mrs. Ross, for instance, I was told this several times, her father may well have turned Unitarian. She did not freely admit to being Jewish, but I was told that she would, if pinned down, she would say she was of Hebrew descent. The only ones that are left today, and there was one marriage between Annette Kirstein and Waterman, and the young man he's not young anymore, who taught at Garland Street Junior High School and was the assistant baseball coaches, is a Waterman, and one of the odd situations is one of the largest pork manufacturers in the state of Maine is W.A. Bean, and the W stands for Weiler, W-E-I-L-E-R, so their background is Jewish, notwithstanding they became pork distributors. And if you go to the Webster Avenue Cemetery, that little cemetery next to the golf course, you will see two family markers with smaller markers around it of the Weiler family. Rose King downtown, a very fancy dress store town, her background was also from the German group. But the library has the original minutes of Ahavat Hashem, and they were kept by the Kirstein family because they were in the real estate business until Alan Waterman became ill and turned them over to Ed Gross 60, 70 years ago. And then we had them, and basically I now run the cemetery. It's a very wealthy cemetery, by the way. It's a very large endowment. But I can tell you the history of how Ahavat Hashem started. I can give you the names of the founders and when they disappeared. Just briefly, a group came in the 1840s, disappeared in 1856. Which I think coincides with the land panic nationally. And then a second group of German Jews came in the 1860s, which included the Kirsteins, the Watermans, the Engels, and so forth.
And they're not related to the first group?
Pardon?
They're not.
No.
Related.
No, they. I think they married mostly non-Jews as quickly as possible. The cemetery, if you look at the Ahavat Hashem minutes, you'll find that they were quite orthodox, and they worried about whether the meat was properly kosher, and I think they sent someone to Boston, New York, to be examined to see what he knew what he was doing. The services were orthodox, but when the Germans came, they took over the cemetery, but immediately buried their non-Jewish wives there and so forth, which would be contrary to orthodox views. But there is a history of, much of it in the Bangor Library already, of Ahavat Hashem. The organization still exists.
What about the relationship between the different synagogues? We might as well broach that topic at this time. Can any of you talk about that?
That's another whole story.
Historically or presently?
Well, first of all, we ought to start that with one of the most popular Jewish jokes about the gentleman that was shipwrecked and he spent 20 years the sole survivor on an island. And when he was rescued, 20 years later, there were two synagogues on the island. And when asked why there were two synagogues, he said, "What? I should go to that synagogue?"
There's another story, a much quicker one. You get a Jew, you get a synagogue. You get two Jews, you get two synagogues.
No, there was always at least when we were young, there was always a really strong feelings between the Ashkenazi Jews or the Lithuanian Jews and intellectuals from Poland versus the Russian Jews, and it was almost like if you were marrying out of your faith if a Ashkenazi Jew married a Russian Jew.
They're both Ashkenazi.
From across the street.
But the Russian Jews started Beth Abraham, as I recall, and what was called the Litvak, a Lithuanian Jew, started Beth Israel.
That's right.
Now,
there
have been splinter groups that went out and came back, and he probably knows what happened at Beth Abraham, and some of it was, they even had to call the police up there once, I understand. There was a splinter group from Beth Israel as well. They came back.
Well, there was a synagogue of the little, they used to call it the Kobritz Shul, that was Toldos Yitzchak, which was, it's now the garden, essentially, right beside Beth Israel. There was an old house there, and there was a synagogue downstairs. They never went inside it. In fact, I never saw anybody coming and going from it, because it was like a family synagogue with a few other members, and that was one of the splinter groups that Norman was alluding to.
That was because of an argument
with some other, some theological or some type of argument.
Rabbi Capra was never accepted by Beth Abraham. That was why that happened.
That's why? Okay.
Rabbi Capra.
So this is Jerry Capra's father?
Grandfather.
Okay.
Grandfather.
And he owned Bangor Candy.
They fought over him and wouldn't agree that he was properly...
He didn't have the proper credentials.
Right.
Okay.
And that's where that one came from. And the Rosh Hashul synagogue...
That was the Russian shul.
The Russian shul. They were always referred to, we're being open here, they were always referred to a bunch of cattle rustlers, because a great many of them were in the cattle business. There were two Goose families, there were two Smith
Stryer,
families.
Stryer.
All in cattle.
All in cattle.
Smith,
Price.
Smith, right.
Colbert's.
Colbert's. They were the cattle rustlers. They had a worse word for them than that, but...
It actually evolved into a physical fight at one time, and then the police were called to Beth Abraham.
So Beth Abraham is the current modern Orthodox synagogue. Beth Israel is the current conservative synagogue. At way back in time, they were both Orthodox synagogues, and Beth Israel joined the conservative movement around 1948.
The late 40s.
And I think as of
this morning, I found out that the sign over Toldos Yitzchak is in the Beth Israel Synagogue at the moment.
Downstairs.
Downstairs.
In the third synagogue today is Beth El, which is the Reform congregation that occupies the former Christian Science Church on French Street. Is
yes,
that right?
Correct.
And that, I'm not sure when it started, in the 80s or
no,
90s?
No, that's incorrect.
Yeah, I don't know.
It started in the 30s.
Oh, the first incarnation.
Right. And Meyer Siegel, we discussed this last time. Meyer Siegel was, I don't know who else was involved, but Meyer Siegel, he was the Siegel of Cortell Siegel, was certainly one of the leaders. Mm-hmm. A man named Philip Kaminsky. Not a trained cantor, but had a good voice and knew the chants, led it. They returned to Beth Israel when Beth Israel went from, and they very often met, by the way, in Dorothy Memorial Hall, which is the recreation hall, to the Unitarian Church on Park Street Hill. They returned to Beth Israel when Bezos went from Orthodox to conservative, and then I think Beth El reincarnated, I think 25 or 30 years ago, with the people who still wanted more reform. There was a breakoff from Beth Israel called Kehilath Yisrael, led by Sidney Epstein's father, Henry Siegel's father. The guru or the man in charge seemed to be Max Ginsburg, because we have letters from him and so forth. They established a separate congregation, a separate cemetery. They came back into Beth Israel. I don't know when or what the circumstances.
How did who participated in the Jewish Community Center, the List Center?
When you say participated,
did it serve all communities?
I could start that conversation.
In the Hebrew school as well.
Okay.
Yeah, there was at one time a community Hebrew school, mm-hmm. and they had actually had a building on State Street next to Elvis. Huh?
Uncle, my great uncle.
Your uncle, right? Great uncle, and that was a community Hebrew school. From that, there were certain social events that were, but nothing of any great magnitude. It was strictly pretty much a Hebrew school. But there were a number of people here. We can talk a little more positively, because our father was one of the ones that was involved very heavily in that. And through all that discussion, they came up with an idea to have, which was not unique to Bangor. It was called a Jewish Community Center. And that was a national movement, which is still very much in business across the country, except here. And a number of people, I can't speak for the Albert side, but I know that my father and a few others spent a great deal of time and money, I guess, in pulling together an organization that became the Jewish Community Center. And then they actually had an organization over it that was really like a holding corporation, which was the Jewish Community Council. And so the council, all the Jewish organizations had a representative to the council.
That was much later, though.
Well, it was later, but the community center sort of grew out of that Hebrew school. And then eventually they bought the Somerset Private School, which is still on, John Vapps owns it now, on the corner of Somerset and French Street. And that was the community center, and it was it combined all of the various factions of the city, and that was really quite successful for many years. They had a paid executive director, eventually built a school building on the side of it, they also ran what was in then those days called the United Jewish Appeal, so that they did centralized funding, not unlike the United Way, except for Jewish causes. And that went on for many, many years. I am a past president. I don't know whether Norman is or not.
Oh.
But
maybe. No.
But quite frankly, from my opinion, this is strictly my opinion, what really broke that up was when the rabbi from Beth Abraham wanted to start a Hebrew day school. And the Stryers had been very generous in building that addition, which was the Hebrew school. So they wanted to use that in the daytime, because the Hebrew school was an after school program. Well, that broke up the community Hebrew school, because the kids that went to Hebrew school and the kids who went to day school, all of a sudden, and then from that, eventually, as the population dwindled, and the rabbi left, because all of his kids were grown up, because he had the school as long as his children were of school age. A nice gentleman, he now lives in Israel. Each of the synagogues at that point felt they had to get their own Hebrew schools. And that sort of was the beginning of the demise of the Jewish Community Center and the council, which also owned, and still does, I suppose, on paper, the mikvah and the funeral chapel.
No, they do not own the mikvah.
But they do own the funeral chapel.
They own the chapel. The chapel was established in the 1950, those records were also in our office, as a separate organization with the understanding that as soon as it was paid for, it would be turned over to the community center. It got paid for, no one bothered to do it until I did it 30 years later. The JCC has collapsed. The only thing it's got left is the chapel, because they did own it, and now the money has been dispersed as an endowment for the chapel and into the Jewish Community Endowment Associates. There was about $500,000 in endowment, and it was split between about $200,000 in endowment for the chapel and about $300,000 went to the Jewish Community Endowment. But it was exceedingly active. The first director was Harry O. H. Levine, and the H. O. H. we used to call him Hell of a Harry Levine, a very bright man. He instituted post bar mitzvah classes, and I have a picture of my graduation from post bar mitzvah classes. They had lecture series. Included in their lectures were Eleanor Roosevelt, and for the Jewish name, Stephen Wise was here, Abba Hillel Silver was here, Ludwig Lewison, who was probably forgotten, I was here. There was a columnist very well known at the time named Pierre Van Passen. He was here, but they had regular lecture series. The Hadassah B'nai B'rith all met there, put on plays and other things. Very successful. It was started within a month, and I'm not sure who was first, but I think Vanagel was, of the same activity in Portland.
And it was a gentleman from Millinocket by the name of Liss who gave the initial contribution.
No, the last contribution.
Well, the last contribution. He gave one of the big ones.
Mr. Liss, Nathan Liss, his wife was a sister to David Brady that we earlier mentioned. And I think he gave the last thing to put him over the top. So the building of the lot became known as the Liss Building.
Well, their name also appears on the gates to the Beth Israel Cemetery. And what business was Mr. Liss in?
He had a clothing store. His wife, his daughter, or maybe his grandchildren, are still living in Millinocket. No connection to the Jewish community. Mm-hmm. And when we collapsed the community center because of the Liss connection and restrictions in his gift, I actually called the sister, the daughter in Millinocket, and she said she didn't care, it was fine. She was very polite, nice, but had no interest, and told me to call David Brady's three daughters and see if they would care. And see, there was Dorothy, Charlotte, and who was the third one? I can't think of it. Anyways, the three Brady said, that's fine, do it, and we sold the building.
What about your generation, Jordan? Did you participate in a lot of those?
Oh, yeah, very actively. Norman and Leonard alluded, it was a very actively thriving community center. And the fact that the Hebrew school was married up to it, literally attached to it, I mean, naturally, the consequence of that was that, you know, you went from school to activities at the JCC or vice versa, so it was an organic whole. They had a pool table upstairs, so as a teenager you go up there and play pool. They had a library there, Jewish books in it, and kids would meet there, and there was a little auditorium, I mean very little, split with a stage, and so there were all kinds of bar mitzvahs and other events there. So I was an active participant. It was a thriving community. I went to Hebrew school in the new building from when I was probably, I don't know, seven or something like that, until I had my bar mitzvah, and was an integral part of my upbringing.
Oh, an anecdote. My wife directed a children's theater program at the Jewish Community Center, but it was open to the public. And she was either having a dress rehearsal or the formal presentation at the end of the term. And one little girl said she couldn't come that day. And when they asked her why, she said, I've got to go to catechism. So they put a little notice in the Bangor Daily News that the Jewish Community Center's youth program, little play, will be Wednesday instead of Thursday, whatever the day was, on account of catechisms. And that was that was what they put in the Bangor Daily News.
Thank you.
There's one other thing that hasn't been mentioned, except he just referenced it, and that's the Jewish Community Endowment Associates. That's another interesting story, I think. It was a gentleman by the name of Bill Viner, who's the Viner Shoe Company, 1 year was the president of the YMCA. And my brother will tell you that he was once introduced as one of the finest Christian gentlemen he ever knew at an annual meeting.
Yes, he was.
But anyway, Bill Viner was very Jewish and very entrepreneurial. And he looked around at the finances of the YMCA and said, well, we've got to have an endowment here. And he was the one that started the endowment for the YMCA in Bangor. And then he turned around and said, well, I think we ought to have one for the Jewish community. So he had a very modest idea, and he gathered a few people together. Here I'm groping a little bit, but I think everyone was supposed to kick in $200 for 10 years or something like that. I don't remember. I think that's what it was. Anyway, so he had no problem doing it, and it became a little bit of a social club. We once had a black tie event out to Pilot's Grill, even, and other people joined over the years, but it didn't do very much, because his concept was that this was something for an emergency fund. If the roof blew off a synagogue, we'd be able to help them. But as that older generation sort of passed away, the organization sort of floundered. I mean, the money was there, but no one was doing anything with it. No one was paying much attention to it. So Max Kagan, who was one of the shoe factories in Old Town, his son Irving, Gerald Redman, an attorney in Bangor, and myself, we sort of resurrected it. And Irving became the president. I guess Gerald became the secretary, and I became the treasurer. And we brought the thing back to life, watched our investment, and today, Norman, what's the...
Unfortunately, we just discovered the fact that this money was split. This is probably unimportant. When the center collapsed and there was $300,000, I said, it sort of went into the wrong pocket. So, still for the benefit, but it got split. It's in the process now, that money, which is the University Foundation, University Main Fund, is being transferred into the Main Fund. That fund will be about $1 million, a little over $1 million. And the interesting thing now is that I think all three synagogues, there's a little bit of an emergency fund, an overflow fund at the university, which is made like when the roof blows off, they get a little money on the side. But that $1 million now is basically the programming for all three synagogues. You know, almost every program at Beth Israel, Beth El, and Beth Abraham, they apply for a grant. And I happened to speak to the rabbi, and he said, eventually every program we have here is because we got a grant from the Jewish Community Endowment. This community has shrunk, and Bill Viner was entirely right. We cannot support three synagogues. So they take care of a portion of it, but almost every bit of educational activity, or even this coming week, a concert, musical concert, is always almost 100% Jewish Community Endowment Associate money.
Thank you.
And the chapel has an endowment of a little over $200,000, which also came from the Jewish when it was split. And so they're substantially self-supporting, but they do get, I think, $1,000 a year from each of the synagogues, because the smaller the community gets, the less funerals, the less income. And they, in the last 2 months, have installed the last four stained glass windows. And all of the stained glass windows are now in place. It's a very attractive building inside. It does have an endowment, and hopefully will survive.
Pardon, but what building was it again?
Jewish Funeral Chapel on Center Street.
Oh.
Is it a funeral chapel?
There is a little background history of the Reformed congregation that is in existence today. And quite frankly, it was formed primarily by a small group of doctors at Eastern Maine Medical Center, many of which had Christian wives who felt uncomfortable at either of the two synagogues but wanted to maintain some semblance of their Judaism. And I went to the organizing meeting of that, which was actually held in one of the conference rooms at the Eastern Maine Medical Center. And there was a half a dozen doctors who were primarily responsible for starting it. My wife's background was Reformed, so we took out dual membership at the time. And that was, from a historical point of view, relatively recent.
Yeah, I can tell you, because I run this Jewish National Fund door-to-door campaign, that roughly two-thirds of the Jews of Bangor, no, that's not incorrect. The membership of Beth Israel is about two-thirds Bangor Jews and one-third outlying. It is reversed at Beth Israel, where the membership is one-third Bangor residents and two-thirds in the outlying area.
You mean Bethel?
Yeah, Bethel.
Did I say Bethel? Yeah. I'm sorry. Bethel is one-third local and two-thirds out of town. Beth Israel is two-thirds in town. The membership of Beth...
Little dyslexia.
That's okay. I'm easily confused. The membership of Beth Abraham is almost 100% Bangor families. And I say Bangor family because half of their membership, I think, Jordan, are the children of the original members who are now out of town. So they have an enormous number of people helping to support the synagogue who no longer live in Bangor, but their families were members of that synagogue.
Speaking of families, we'll get maybe some questions now that are more, focused on your families of origin. What did your parents feel was most important for you to learn? The most important lesson they taught you? What would you say?
Well, your first question was easy to answer. You said, what was the most important thing our parents did for us? And that was to have us. You changed the question, so that I didn't have an answer for the second one.
Did you want to answer, Leonard? Or
yeah.
Well, I've been doing quite a lot of talking. I think it's someone else.
I can keep it simple. I mean, education. I mean, that's first and foremost. Without an education, you're not going to, first of all, realize your full potential as a human being. So the more education up to a certain point, the more of a self-realized person you're going to be. And so that was, and I think all of us would probably give the same answer. And I'm not speaking for you, but I think it's, and I think when we talked in our last session, we talked about the importance of education, that the generation that were the first American generation, that is, the parents were the immigrants, the children were the first American-born children, the emphasis was tremendously focused on education. That's the only way, it's the one great equalizer. So if you become a medical doctor, if you become an accountant, you become an attorney, nobody can ever take that away from you. And remember, they came from backgrounds where things were confiscated all the time, not to mention their lives were potentially confiscated, so to speak. So that's the big point.
And he's absolutely right. I think in my home, in a most Jewish home, it's not whether you were going to college. The only real question is which one were you going to go to. It's just a given.
Well, I think there's an addition to that, and I'm sure that I can speak for the Alta family as well. And there was an element of community. I won't call it camaraderie, but there was a certain community spirit that you weren't alone. that you were in, that you took some interest and some care for other people, and that you weren't just going through life just for yourself. And I think that was one of the lessons that I think most of us was imparted to most of us. I can remember my father years ago saying, from an educational point of view, you've got to live with yourself the rest of your life, so you might just well make yourself the best you can. That was rather simply said. But I think there was a sense of community, and I think that there was a sense of ethics involved in all of this. You didn't always take; you had to give.
And even just one comment on that education. I think the education in many cases was that the Jew could not depend on the Christian community because banks wouldn't hire them, insurance companies hire them. It was known you shouldn't be an engineer. So the emphasis, the family business or a profession. Because as a professional man, you did not depend on a Christian boss.
Right. Absolutely. This is an important point. Something I was going to make that point where we talk about the businesses, that if you look through a city directory, for example, you would not see a single Jewish employee of any of the banks, not Eastern Trust, not Merrill Trust, not Merchants National Bank, not Penobscot Savings, not Bangor Savings Bank, none of them, nor in any of the financial businesses. Now, Edward Viner, which was Bill, one of the Viner brothers, he started his own brokerage business. And, he probably attracted a lot of Jewish clientele because there were no Jews hired by David Mead. Well, I don't mean to point because I don't know the reasons why, other than to say that to emphasize the point that you had to be self-sufficient, and if you weren't going to enter one of the professions, you had to you were going to have a family business that you were going to inherit or something, and because you couldn't necessarily rely on others to accept you. So
now, to the credit of the Bangor community, that has evolved.
Oh, so it's night and day.
Night and day. We've had Jewish men on most of the bank boards in Bangor.
It's totally different. In speaking to which, in
but that's more about, recent than you might think.
Leonard was mentioning community service, and in a few comments ago, we was talking about the YMCA. So that the picture is a balanced one. The YMCA was a integrated organization way back in time, and I mean way back in time. My dad was going to be 100 in a couple of weeks. He was a camper at Camp Jordan back in 1924. Or 1926, and he has a picture of himself with his cousin Sidney Alpert of the same name, who went on to become an MD, at standing in front of a teepee at Camp Jordan. I went to Camp Jordan. Both of my brothers went to Camp Jordan. And I went to Camp Prentice also, and I was a member of a fraternity at the YMCA. So not just in my time, in his time, the YMCA was an integrated, so to speak, organization. So. It was not just C in the YMCA, it was everybody in the YMCA. So I don't know about your experience.
I went to Camp Jordan.
You went to Camp
Jordan?
Yeah, okay.
Did you want to talk about it?
No. Well, yes, I'll mention one thing, because I used to tease the director, and he thought I was quite wrong. Mandatory Christian services, including for the Jewish kids, Sunday morning. They brought the Catholics to Mass in Ellsworth, and everyone else left in camp attended a Christian service at the camp.
I don't remember that.
I went to, there were mandatory services Sunday morning. I remember they were led by Bill Bennett, who was the camp director. And, I can't speak for Norman, but my experience of it was that it was pretty generic. Very generic, and it was more of an interfaith religious service. Again, we went at different times. I'm talking about I went to Camp Jordan, I was in, this is 1962 or something like that, and you might have gone in 1940.
Early 40s.
Yeah, 42. So 20 years earlier might have been different. But in my experience, it was more like an interfaith Christian oriented. But I found it, I appreciated it for what it was, and it was a new experience for me, and
What about Shabbat? What about how did that impact your observing Sabbath?
Oh, at camp?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't. I mean, if you went away to camp, you just, or if you went away to YMCA camp, you just went with the flow. In our family, we were members of an Orthodox synagogue, so we remember. I grew up at first. Our family was a member. Were members of Beth Israel, and all the Alperts and Cohens were members of Beth Israel, and it was one of the founders was an Alpert Cohen. But when I was a little kid, we went over to Beth Abraham. They had a new rabbi, young guy, Rabbi Isaacs, very charismatic, played the guitar, sang this and that. And my parents had close friends over there. They lured them over there. So I grew up really remembering Beth Abraham, and even though we were not Orthodox per se, we were traditional Jews, but we were not Sabbath observant. My dad kept his business open. We went to work. It was just Saturday instead of Thursday. There was no, it didn't have any impact.
Did you want to talk about your experiences at camp at all? At Camp Jordan.
What about them?
Experiences.
I only went there 1 week because I got thrown out of the Camp Roosevelt.
Oh dear.
I didn't get thrown out. In those days, they only allowed troops to stay so long. So when our troop was cycled out, it was during the period of time, and I guess probably the same thing with you, Norm. It was between mothers. So that's what my father did with us in the summertime. So I went to Jordan for just a week or two to finish out what I hadn't been able to finish at Roosevelt. So I hardly remember even being at Jordan. I don't remember feeling any pressure while I was there, one way or another. Nor in the Boy Scouts, as far as that goes. And one of your relatives was scout leader at the Jewish Community Center.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Isidore was our scout.
I'm no kidding.
Was our scoutmaster.
Yeah.
It was Troop 3. It was at the Jewish Community Center. It was all Jewish, I believe.
Yeah, it was.
And Izzy Alpert was the scoutmaster.
Interesting. I didn't know that.
Isidore Alpert, he later ran, or was then running, this Mormon Tobacco in Old Town. That was what he was doing.
It was Izzy. Is he yours or is he mine?
One of his sons is now living in Israel, and I don't know what
Bruce.
Huh?
Bruce, he was
yeah.
a physicist who now he's a patent attorney. Actually, he's a very smart guy. Yeah.
Well, Leonard, you were talking, I think, earlier about a family feeling and things. He didn't put it that way, but you talked about. Not just education, but caring and doing for others was
part of. Well, that was certainly
experience.
One of the lessons that we learned. I don't know that that's a particularly Jewish feeling or not, but you asked me what came out of our household,
mm-hmm.
so that was certainly, and I wasn't restricted only to Jewish causes.
Mm-hmm.
My father had more lapel pins than you could shake a stick at. Masons, Shriners, Art Fathers, he must have had, he could have a different lapel pin every week. And my mother, I know, headed the March of Dimes campaign at least once, if not twice. So, so there was family involvement. And
my father was a veteran of World War One and a air raid warden in World War Two.
In terms of community service, did they do a lot to?
Well, I would not say that they were involved in. I mean, my dad was not a member of any fraternal organizations or anything like that. and his father was. I mean, he was in the Odd Fellows and I don't know whatever else, but and in fact, on his headstone, there's an IOOF with a little symbol, and I had no idea what it meant.
International Order of Odd Fellows,
right. And I thought it might have been foresters, and I said to myself, why would he be in the... Except that his father was a lumberman, but that's... So what? You know, anyway, so in his generation, yes, my dad's generation, I mean, he was so busy running his business and working 12 and 14 hours a day that you know, he wasn't really actively involved in any of those types of organizations. And my mom worked as well. So, you know, that was their focus, doing that and raising their family. And, you know, we were sent to Hebrew school, and the idea was not just to prepare, because my sister went to Hebrew school also, not just to prepare for your bar mitzvah, but to get a Jewish education. And, you know, what is the backbone of a Jewish education, aside from learning the prayers and, you know, and so forth, and so an understanding, you know, coming to an understanding of Jewish history and all of that, is the ethical framework of, you know, of the religion, which is, you know, the foundation of the whole, you know, Judeo-Christian tradition and the foundation of Western law and Western civilization. So, you know, one thing is a, you know, consequence of the other.
The comment sometimes that, well, I don't know how to explain, but Christianity is more involved with love of this or that. The basis for Judaism seems to be justice and righteousness, and it's mentioned throughout the Bible. And there were courts and court systems and laws, and the day off which we have was started with Jews, and slavery was permitted, but you had to free your slave
after seven years,
and if he refused, you marked him as something wrong. He was an outcast in the community. He wanted to be a slave. So the idea of righteousness, the dealings between and the devout, the whole, as he pointed, the whole Jewish law, which still exists, but no one uses it anymore. So justice, righteousness, with the foundations.
When you say that, I'm thinking that in the Jewish conception of slavery, they taught their slaves in a very, well, I won't say loving, but in a kind way. It was different than conception. Well,
there were intricate laws about how you could treat your slave, and you had to treat him like a member of the family. There's all kinds of commentary, Torah commentaries about that. Mm-hmm. And you know, I'm not sure if the microphone caught my comment, but when Norman was talking about slavery, after 7 years, you had to release your slave. And as he was saying, if they didn't want to be released, they became almost like a pariah. And maybe that's too extreme of a term. But
the most liberal divorce laws of the era, and the rights of women, limited, but something, sprung out of this same period of time.
I had to go back. When you talk about slavery, we're not talking about modern slavery.
No, I know, yeah. I know.
I mean, we're not talking about Civil War. Most of the slavery that these two gentlemen are talking about are pre-Christ, because once the Jews were dispersed, there was no... They didn't take their slaves to Babylon yet.
No.
and no, so,
they were the ones who became the slaves.
Yeah. So those were gone many, many thousands of years ago, literally.
Right.
There still exists Jewish religious courts, and some of the ultra-Orthodox will still settle their disputes in a Jewish religious court, but there are very few and far between.
Well, I'm thinking about, you know, family and caring. What dreams did your parents have? Did they talk about their dreams and what, you know, what they wanted to see in the world, something that was achieved or not?
I don't remember much discussion about that. Maybe Norman does. He was younger than I am, you know. I left home sooner than he did. But No, I think they probably had the same kind of feelings that probably all Americans had. You know, you want each generation to be better than, to do better than you, and you hope that comes, that you can help to accomplish that. I'm not sure in that particular case there's anything Jewish about that. I don't know if maybe you can comment on that, but.
Well, really, there was one element that was different, and that was Zionism. And all of what Linda says is correct. As far as their own life, Jordan will speak on it, in his life, they wanted the same thing that everybody wanted. But they were aware of the plight of Jews, the history of Jews, they're aware, whether it was the Holocaust or the older generation, the pogroms of the turn of the century, the idea that there had to be a haven where Jews could live unmolested was the probably the additional element beyond the typical.
But not unlike the Irish, who wanted Ireland to be free, so that was a national learning, you know, that particular thing was very Jewish to us because we lived through it, but I'm sure that the Irish lived through the same thing, and the Kurds are living through it today. That's a universal feeling and not restricted to Judaism.
I'm going to add a comment to that. So I'm of a little bit of a different generation. I can speak on behalf of my parents, which all I can say is they didn't really articulate any ideals in terms of the way you've positioned or asked your question, but one of their three children was very idealistic, and that was my Aunt Katja. And she was, I would say, in her time, she had a vision of that was very progressive, social justice, the things that are so predominant today. You know, 70 years ago, she was on the avant-garde of that type of stuff, and very political. And her husband. Must have been one of the reasons why they married, and shared a similar vision. But I think the seeds of it probably came from my my grandfather.
I think I remember her.
Yeah, Katja, and she
was
very good friends with
Harry Sundown.
Harry Sundown, right? She was very good friends with Rose LeVoot. You mentioned the last time the LeVoots,
right.
They had a bakery, and
I remember that.
Yeah, they were very close.
Yeah,
and. So in those times, you were talking about the 20s and the 30s, we're talking, this is a long time ago. Things were very different. I mean, the world was different. This country was different. This community was very different. So, and there was kind of an overt idealism that now is just, everybody on this campus, or most people on this campus, would project similar things, so or similar type of.
Yeah, but I remember her reputation, and she certainly was about to say the least.
I think a bit goes back, and the Jewish voter is always considered primarily a Democratic voter, and I think part of it is because this idea of social justice, the idea of righteousness, and so forth, was somewhat embedded in them. I'm sure it was historical, but also when you're the low man on the totem pole, you seek social justice, or it may have been pressures of the world around them as well.
Well, I'm thinking about asking about maybe your bar mitzvah. When
I can't hear you.
Your bar mitzvah?
Mm-hmm.
Your bar mitzvah. I'm thinking, the speech you gave. The speech
your
you
bar
gave.
Mitzvah speech.
Your bar mitzvah speech.
No.
I think the word perfunctory comes to mind.
I didn't even give one.
I have a copy of mine, but I did not write it. Joseph Mintz, the Hebrew school teacher, wrote it.
Well.
And that was done in those days.
No, I didn't write mine. I wrote mine.
I didn't. I have it in Mr. Mintz's handwriting.
It was a good party. You know, it was supposed to have real religious significance, and maybe among the more Orthodox it did, because you now could be counted as a member of the synagogue. But as far as I was concerned, you know, how many fountain pens can you use?
Well, I guess that's kind of leading into it. I'm thinking about how much your, you know, your religion informed your identity, and you've all been answering it, I think, all along in different ways about the meaning.
Their bar mitzvahs have become much a social, I may have mentioned the last, much a social event as a religious event, and they can get out of hand. It's also very difficult for people who cannot afford fancy events. And when I was president of the synagogue, I went to several families and said, can we tone this down? And the answer was basically the same. I think you're absolutely right. I think it should be done, and you should start right after mine.
So your question is there a specific question in terms
of...
Well,
I'm just wondering, you know, about community and, you know...
You mentioned something about informing, you know, what...
Right.
How much has Judaism, what part is it
identity,
in terms of...
Yeah, I mean, you know...
Well, I probably speak for all of us, but
yeah.
But I only speak myself enormously.
Yeah.
No, absolutely no question about it. And you know, from a multiple perspective. First of all, being Jewish, Judaism is not just a religion. You're a member of a people. You're a member of an ancient people, and with a long line of continuity. And with ideals that have been refined over a long period of time. And those ideals are precious. First and foremost is a belief in God. It's a monotheistic religion. You're believing in an invisible, undefinable, you know, inscrutable being, but nevertheless you believe. And that you also believe that that's where these ethics and laws came from. They were not man-made. So, you know, it has to start, I believe, with that. And if you reduce it all to something of human manufacture, then I think the impact would probably be considerably less. It's the difference. It's a black and white difference. So, being part of a people, part of this tremendous movement over a long period of time. And especially now with the creation of the State of Israel and it thriving as it has, where, you know, people have been able, you know, emigrated there. It's a, you know, it's the fulfillment of long cherished dreams. So yes, for me, it's a tremendous part of my identity. And but as I said, I assume. For Norman and Leonard as well, but maybe in a slight
way. I would describe everything he said, plus this idea of peoplehood is such that there are people whom we consider very good Jews because they are involved, they are interested, they do things, and yet don't really believe in God. And that's acceptable. There are many Jews that we say, he's a good Jew. Yet he will say, I doubt there's a God, or I don't know there's a God, or I don't believe in God. Judaism is very much based, well, the word bar mitzvah, it means son of commandments. So Judaism is very much based on what you do, not just belief, what you do, on mitzvahs.
Yeah, I don't mind saying I'm probably an agnostic Jew, or even a secular Jew. And you know, the traditional thing is that the laws and the Torah came from the hand of God. I'm one that doesn't buy into that. They may have been God inspired from whatever they were developing as their code of ethics and all that sort of stuff. So if you want to call it God inspired, that's fine. You know, and A perfect example of that is that three-fourths of the people in Israel are not religious, but they certainly consider themselves Jewish. So being Jewish does not necessarily mean going to the synagogue every week or every day or every night. So it has evolved. Now, not necessarily made everyone happy. No, nor does everyone agree. But that's a fact of what's happened. I mean, that's a historical timeline. I can see that in my own family.
There is no dogma, a creed that you must follow.
No, but there are the 13 principles of faith. Those go back. Those are created by Maimonides.
Even those who doubt that, you see here, even those that say, okay, that's not important, but yet they're good Jews.
Well, one of the Jews that was
no disputing that.
Back in, he was Dutch. His name was Spinoza, and he was literally excommunicated. All of a sudden, not all of a sudden, but today there's a revival, another whole group of people and thinking of looking back at Spinoza and seeing that, you know, he was maybe not so far out. He was far out for his time. But now there's a whole intellectual study of what Spinoza stood for or didn't stand for, which is kind of interesting.
Anyway. Now you know why there were three Schultz.
Yeah, right.
but not disputing anything Norman has said or anything Leonard is saying, absolutely the focus on Judaism isn't really belief, it is action.
Right, we can agree
on. Yeah, we all agree on that, action, because the end result should be the same thing. You know, what the catalyst for the action was, whether it's because God commanded you to do it or because the action itself is a good thing to do, the result is the same.
The Christians use the word faith-based religion. Jews will not use that phrase. That phrase doesn't really apply.
Some Jews, I would
okay. Oh yeah, they're certainly in that category, but it's not the whole group cannot be considered under that category.
Yeah.
It's wide. You can get both extremes.
Variety, yeah.
You can get both extremes.
But the same thing is true within Christianity. I mean, there are multiple denominations.
Sure.
Different emphases, very different emphases. You know, whether it's from Universalist Unitarian on one end to the Catholic Church, you know, on the other end. You know, that's you know, central, you know, with a central authority with one figure at the top, including the Russian Orthodox, or separately the Russian Orthodox or the Greek Orthodox Church, with these structures versus loose-knit, you know, individually based Bible-based churches all that are scattered all over the place.
Well, this is what the Catholic Church is going through today, with the current Pope, who I'm quite friendly with one of the priests in Bangor, and boy, he's having a hard time. He really is. Traditions have gone, and this is gone, and the new emphasis on social justice and all this sort of stuff, and the whole litany and of masses being differently done. He is not very happy. Comes from another generation.
I'm wondering what topics we haven't covered in either interview that you really would like to talk about or share.
Well, I think we've covered an awful lot.
I think that maybe there hasn't been enough, and I think, Leonard, you were just touching on this. You were quite friendly with a Catholic priest and so forth and so on. If you go into the lobby of the new Beth Abraham Synagogue, new because the original one burned. Well, they had a fire and it didn't burn down. They demolished it and replaced it in 1985, I believe, somewhere around there, with a lovely sanctuary. You go in and there's a board in the front, and it lists who contributed to the the reconstruction of the synagogue. And you know what? There's various churches and other organizations So there's an interfaith element that the city of Bangor is, I can't say it's a microcosm for anywhere else, but it's a much more of an organic whole, at least, you know, it used to be.
And I may have mentioned before, I was president of the synagogue when there was extensive vandalism at the Beth Israel Cemetery.
A few years ago.
Yeah, and there's been from the synagogue, this was a cemetery, stones knocked over, swastikas over. Many contributions came from churches, small ones, but not just in Bangor, Bradford, maybe Corinth, maybe small towns around sent contributions.
To
Christian churches.
Yeah. So there's I think an ecumenical spirit that you know, rather than of X number of years ago when things used to be more apart, they're much more synthesized, and I think there's a much more sense of mutual respect among, you know, the various faiths. And it you know, shows in those types of things those examples. So it's all very positive. Very positive.
Do you want to add anything? Mine are just thinking. You look like you're deep in thought.
I wasn't deep in thought. I don't have very many deep thoughts anymore.
Well,
I think this has been an interesting conversation, and I hope that we've been reasonably historically accurate,
this idea of caring for Jews care for each other. My father told the story that after World War I, there was great starvation all across Europe, and there were Jewish organizations organizing to take care of Jewish communities. So he went to the conference in New York, which is probably the forerunner of UJA or whatever it was at the time, and someone came to my father and said that Henry Morgenthau wants to see you. My father said, couldn't understand. Henry Morgenthau was huge, important New York banker. This would be the father of the man that later became Secretary of Treasury in the Roosevelt administration. And so my father did go to see him, and he said, we don't have any organized collection or movement in Bangor, Maine. And he said, I understand there is a Kirstein family, German Jews. He said, is that correct? And he asked about them and so forth. Apparently, Mr. Morgenthau wrote to Louis Kirstein, and this was a family that really didn't involve itself in Jewish affairs. My father said that Louis Kirstein probably appeared at Beth Israel Synagogue in the day when they were all very foreign-looking Jews, maybe for the only time, and he probably helped organize the first drive in Bangor, because he's not about to turn down Mr. Morgenthau. Later on, the Kirsteins made token contributions to the synagogue or something or other. My father said they were always balanced by a contribution to a non-Jewish, as far as he could tell, to a non-Jewish function. But it's just a story of, even then, here was this totally emancipated, educated people, but there were Jews starving in Europe in 1919, therefore you had to organize the community. It's that sense of community that Leonard referred to.
Thank you. I'm down to my last question. What would you like listeners of this interview years from now to take away concerning the Jewish community of Bangor, Maine?
I think the only thing that we really can hope for is that we left a little portion of what we remembered ourselves and our remembrances of what the Jewish community was from our perspective in the slice of history that we have covered. I don't know that this is my personal, this is my personal take on it. I don't know that we can accomplish a great deal more than that. We're not gonna bring peace on the Korean Peninsula, or save any of the synagogues from their own destruction internally. So that's what I feel. That would be my take.
Go ahead, Jordan. All right.
Well, I think with Bangor, you're talking about a city that has had its ups and downs, and so has the Jewish community. I mean, the Jewish community is probably the population or size of the Jewish community at this point is a fraction of what it was when I was growing up here, and that is a result, I think, first and foremost of people going away to school, process of this education that I talked about, and subsequently going where the opportunities exist. They typically do not exist in a small community. They exist in, you know, in Atlanta, in Boston, in Chicago, Los Angeles, wherever, you know, people meet spouses, they marry, they settle down in these various places. So the community has evolved but devolved, meaning it's evolved in terms of no longer, you know, being concerned about not being accepted on the board of directors of a bank on the one hand, but devolved in terms of the size. It's shrunk, and it will probably continue to shrink. So I think we've captured or tried to capture a small fraction of what was a tremendously rich community in its history. And maybe others, you know, if you continue this series, will each contribute, you know, their memories and to help give a more enriched view of what the community was like, because it was really something. I mean, it just as Bangor tried to be like a little Boston. In terms of the size of its community when it was in the heyday of its lumber boom and all of that stuff and the grand buildings that were built and so forth and so on, Jewish community built their own institutions. They had the synagogues, the JCC, the Hebrew school, and so forth and so on. And it was really a remarkable place. So,
what they both said is absolutely correct. And all I wanted to add was that the diminution of population is my main concern, but we are extraordinarily fortunate. And you see, this goes back to William Viner and his community endowment. We are a small community, and yet we still run educational entertainment programs. The synagogues are running them, but they are running them with the money from the community endowment. And they said that endowment is now approximately $1 million. And that is what's going to save the culture. We would not have the community we have today without that endowment.
It started with a seed that germinated and built, and accrued, built. Somebody didn't just write a check for $1 million and give it to the community endowment, Jewish Community Endowment Associate. So just like everything else, it accumulated. A good analogy.
Oh, thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you for having us.
Did you cover everything that they wanted you to cover? I know that she asked, but like, you were assigned to come and talk to us. Mm-hmm. Norman, weren't you assigned to come and talk to us? Didn't the synagogue want specific things? Did we talk about all of those?
I didn't hear what she said.
Okay, so.
But we can correct these and mail them back.
No, what she's asking is, she's asking you, did not the synagogue want certain things covered in this dialogue, I'm unaware of any of that.
I was not aware of that. You know, this is something like, I was chairman of the City of Bangor's Bicentennial Celebration. And I think I'm the only one that ever ran a citywide celebration that ended up with a profit. So I was quite pleased about that. So I went to the City of Bangor and I said, I want you to set up a separate account for the tricentennial. Now, you'll have 100 years of interest to do on that. Well, the doggone thing got lost in the city, and eventually I went back to, and the city treasurer and the city solicitor found the money, and the account is still there. So for a number of years, every year, I made a deposit to it. But, you know, this is what we're doing. I don't know what's going to happen 100 years, the tricentennial, but at least we made a contribution to it. Every so often I check on it to make sure the account's still there. The problem is the Bangor Savings Bank is not paying any interest.
So no one is.
It's languishing.
None of them are.
Yeah.
All right, thank you.